introduce Dr. Randy Keller. And this is Dr. George Randy Keller, not to be confused with our own Randy Keller. Dr. Randy Keller is from the University of Oklahoma. He is the professor and Edward Lamb McCullough Chair in Geophysics at the University of Oklahoma. Many of us know him from his work at the University of Texas at El Paso, but he has recently moved to Oklahoma, and we're very, very pleased to have him here, our second speaker from the University of Oklahoma. Dr. Keller is known worldwide for his work in geophysics, structure and tectonics of the lithosphere. He's been involved in several large seismic projects throughout the western United States and has collaborated with a broad range of geophysicists and geologists from Stanford and Caltech and Duke, University of British Columbia, the U.S. Geological Survey, and our own Oregon State University. In fact, Dr. Keller is working with Anita Grunder right now on a continental dynamics project.
And Bob Duncan,
and maybe some others. Maybe Ann Trajan, who has been a past collaborator. But I'm familiar with the continental dynamics project going on right now in Eastern Oregon. Dr. Keller is also known for his work internationally. He's done some wonderful work on the East African Rift, and he was just telling me today about work in Poland and the rest of Eastern Europe in terms of mapping the crust and the upper mantle there. And Dr. Keller is also very distinguished in the emerging field of geoinformatics, which brings us around to the connection to this lecture series, because there's a lot of work going on in the geological and geophysical community with regard to advanced techniques for computation and for visualization, certainly for data management. And Dr. Keller has been at the forefront of that area in geology and geophysics. He's involved with the Geoinformatics Initiative or Division within the Geological Society of America. He's also been the program chair of the Geoinformatics Conference in 2006, and that is now a series of conferences that takes place every year on this very important theme. And that brings us to the subject of his talk today, where he's going to talk about visualization and modeling, computation of the Earth's structure. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Randy Keller.
Well, thank you. I have a lot of slides to show, so she took too long wasting talking about me there. But what's the motivation of some of this? Well, certainly one of them is EarthScope, this big initiative that the Solid Earth program at NSF and the community's been endeared with, and is off and rolling and in good shape, and will eventually move a transportable array of instruments all the way across the country into Alaska. And then we have other instruments that, as individual principal investigators, we can write proposals and deploy these to specific geologic targets. So this is one of the real driving things for certainly young ones, for the beginning of your careers, and is the thing that when that's over, I will be too. Anyway, as you try to tell the difference between your Randy Keller and mine, and me, just remember I'm the good-looking one. Not the hairy one, but... So at any rate, GEON is this large information technology research project that really was, although not in any really official way, but was certainly, I think it's, I know it's fair to say, one of the main drivers of GEON was EarthScope, and bringing the integration of other kinds of data, not in any way to be involved in the data flow from this huge deployment of facilities, but when all that's in process, stored away in the catalogs, and we're ready to put it together and make an integrated story, why that's where GEON is certainly one of the things, it's one of the major things it's trying to do. So, and it's just a whole people at a whole bunch of universities, and now really GEON, it was intended to be, and I think we were just talking early this afternoon, I think maybe in the last year or so, it's been, I think people realize it is kind of, it's intended to be a cyber infrastructure umbrella that develops tools and stuff that, that other, when another community wants to put together a database and a system to query it and be able to meld in with the other elements of this system, why we can provide them the software and guidance so that they were not doubling up on that kind of effort, because it's tedious. We are, when it's all said and done, we are scientists, and the only reason to be doing this is to be able to do our science better. And so it that's the only reason I'm doing this. So what I want to show you today is, and the reason why I say a look to the future, I can show you some real examples of things we've done in 2D. I can talk about some stuff that realize very little of this as far as this ultimate integrated 3D model can be done today. And I think we have a decent idea of how we would like to do it, and we're developing some of the pieces, but we have a long ways to go on this. But the overall flow that we imagine is to take a variety of data, do an integrated analysis, an analytical or mathematical analysis, build some sort of highly three-dimensional model, and have it immediately be nicely ingestible into some sort of modeling, dynamic modeling situation, and then crunch some numbers. And as we said in Geon, I mean, it is, when you hear about cyber infrastructure and so forth, don't necessarily think about supercomputers. It's not about heroic computations, was a term we used early on, but in some cases that's what you need. So if you need it, you crunch the numbers, you get your model, and you spend a lot of time. The last movie I'll show you took 240 processors, 5 days to produce the result. So when you've marshaled that many resources to make a big run, why the output of the model itself is something to be stored. And then the tricky part is, okay, that model doesn't, that model's kind of nice, it kind of sort of approximates reality, but actually our problem is that we need to iterate this model and get more data and make it more realistic so that the model results look more like we look like, in essence, the data that from which they are derived. So that cycle can go around many times. And the problem we have right now is the in essence the software tools needed to do editing and even build these models and so forth. So this is at least this Randy Keller's view of what the ultimate goal in geophysics is, and this is part of it. We want to look at data volumes. We want to look at these voxels and assign as many physical properties as possible. I know a lot of you are not geophysicists, but it's very intuitive to say that if I have measured 4 or 5 physical properties of this chunk of the Earth, and this is very scale independent. This could be a box that's down in a manhole that's 10 kilometers on a side, or it could be a 1 meter on a side and be part of some groundwater flow problem or a waste disposal problem. And one nice thing about geophysics is most of the tools, not all of them, but most of them scale up and down. They're just as applicable at the scale of this room as they are of the scale of the entire Earth, and in many cases the exact software can stand up to that much scale change. But at any rate, it's intuitive that if I have measured 4 or 5 physical properties, not just seismic velocity, not just density, but many other things, and I must be able to derive from that, therefore, a model of the Earth's structure that is significantly less ambiguous than if I have a model that only satisfies one kind of data. And it's really not any more complicated than that. We want to come up with the best resolved, most reliable, however you want to say it, model that that we possibly can. The tricky part in geology, again, this is an attempt to show a subduction zone here. which is relevant to this part of the world. And here's the slab peeling off. But however you look at it, in geology, we also need interfaces. The geologic flesh on many of these geophysical models is derived by putting in interfaces, faults, stratigraphic horizons, boundaries between lava flows, the Moho, the 660 kilometer discontinuity in the mantle. All these interfaces are very important, and that's a very tricky part of this. But as I decided to put this in early because I really have to talk about tomography a bit, and I know some of you are not particularly familiar with that. But the nice thing about tomography, seismic tomography, it's like doing a CAT scan. So if anybody's in here been unfortunate enough to have a CAT scan, why, you've been sent through a tube and bombarded, and the sensors have done the travel time through you, and you end up with a picture of your innards. Well, we're doing the same thing here to the Earth in places, and in this particular case, this is from a big project done in South Africa. Matt Fouch down at Arizona State put these pictures together, but the blocks here, the white blocks, are seismic stations. And down in here, then, is being shown this big cube and all the little subcubes in it. We're trying to derive a velocity model of as much of this big underpinning of this thing, in this case down several hundred kilometers, as possible. And the way to achieve this, you basically look at your data. You can you line the data, and it's all based on the arrival times of the P waves from the earthquakes and the S waves from the earthquakes. And you can, what you then imagine is, here's some sort of target down here, and here's the, went the wrong way. Here's seismic rays coming up. They've gone from a very distant earthquake, they've gone way down in the earth, and they're now coming up, and they're intersecting this thing. And if you, what you will see, if this is a low velocity body, and in all that, well, I'll show several examples of tomography in our normal procedure there, is if it's slow, why, it produces a delay. So these rays that don't hit this thing come in faster than these ones that travel, the ones that travel through the most of the low velocity body are delayed the most in their travel time. And so if you have another earthquake in another place, why, you get a similar situation. And if you now have dozens of these stations on the Earth's surface, you have dozens of earthquakes, why then in three dimensions you have all these seismic rays coming through, and at least through most of a volume, you're able to relatively well define the seismic velocity structure. And so we have a big cube now, and here is, for instance, the seismic velocity here at 150 kilometers down in the Earth. So you have this big cube, and you can slice it any way you want to for visualization purposes. And so here is a horizontal slice. This is South Africa. This is where the diamond mines are and so forth, the very old rocks. And we have this story about in recent years we've kind of appreciated that the lithosphere of the Earth is thicker in these Archean, these very ancient geologic provinces, than in other areas. And so here's the blue areas are fast, in other words, cold, and so you have this Archean area that's underlain by cold, fast routes. We'll come back to this, but I just wanted to explain in general tomography. Let me show you how we kind of do this integration. This is here's a project we did in Poland, and the Polish air detonated about 60 shots. We brought most of the seismographs to the party, and did quite an elaborate survey here, and followed it up with several more. So it was really a spectacular effort on the part of our Central European colleagues. And I just want to show you this particularly long line. It goes all the way from East Germany to Lithuania through Poland. And perhaps people don't know much about the geology of Poland, but it turns out it's pretty complicated. And here we'd be then plotting the travel times, all these pits of the data here, and you can see that different, what we've done is color code these by the geologic province, and you can see that the East European Craton, the coal stable part of it is fastest. That means the as you increase distance here, the travel time is relatively less than for the slower areas. And the really slow area here is the Trans-European Suture Zone. And if you look here, this is 20 kilometers. So there is a huge pocket here. It happens to be sedimentary rocks, in our opinion. We of course, don't have samples down that deep. They do produce oil and gas here, but they've never, of course, drilled down quite to that depth. And the issue is really, is it how metamorphosed is it? But and then this is really Paleozoic Western Europe. This is part of the Siberian Craton, or the Baltic Craton, and here's the suture zone in between, and here's a much younger terrain to the west. Well, the tomography, the only problem with the tomography is that it produces a very smooth model, and so we're not going to get the interface, so we're not going to get the geologic flesh. And so here's these kind of data that we call refraction data. There's really many, many reflections in it. And so here, just showing you the actual seismograms. Here are is showing how we trace the rays through the Earth. We just apply Snell's law, going down, hitting an interface, calculating, and finding a model that whereby the travel times here, and at least approximately the amplitudes. So what we're showing here is synthetic seismograms that actually match both the amplitude approximately and match the travel times of these very well. So therein comes the interfaces. And then here, instead of that rather fuzzy model, here is one with lots of geologic flesh on it. And it's highly integrated. Like up here, what you're seeing, those are actually salt zones. So this is an area of Permian salt, so the Permian Basin here, and what they have not explored there, which is similar to parts of the United States, is underneath the salt. So it was a really nice, from the Polish perspective, the Polish National Oil Company paid for quite a bit of this. They had enough foresight to realize that some of this might help them. I wish American companies would be a little more that forward thinking, but nonetheless, they provided, using seismic reflection data and drill holes, a geologic section here that we could put into this model, hold fixed while we did the other operation. So it's a truly integrated result. We calculated the gravity response to this, and even looking for heat flow across it too. But the point was to get that picture. But that's all well and good, but that is too deep. And so, not that this is this area, this is a nice diagram from a commercial source, but it's just showing what those, if you zoomed in on that thing, this shows, like, this is the kind of thing that we want to be able to build in a really integrated way here, where we've got, in this particular case, these could be intrusions. If this were the whole crust, these could be intrusions. In this case, this is drawn for salt domes covered by sedimentary rocks. Well, one of the things we have to do here is define our terms, and not everybody would agree with what I'm about to say here, but I think in the geosciences, and we'll go through examples of each of these, but I think it's kind of important to kind of understand the different things here. No, there's nothing wrong with 2D. I've done 2D things most of my career. But as we think through this, what we ultimately really are talking about, if you read the Earthscope proposal and some before that, the idea of the 4D Earth. If you're just looking at mathematics, 4D can be something is a function of x1, x2, x3, and
four.
But as geoscientists, that's going to be three spatial dimensions of time. That's the way we almost always use that term. But at any rate, we want to go through here, and this is just my way of thinking about this. And we're here in a department with all sorts of geospatial capabilities. And so that kind of thing, I mean, they're just almost an endless stack of layers you can produce. And mixing and matching these in visual ways, or even using them, imagine those of you that do remote sensing, you can actually think about using one band of Landsat data, a aeromagnetic map, and maybe radar data. Put them into the blue, green, and red guns of your NV software, and out comes some fused image, the likes of which you're not used to thinking about. But at any rate, we have a million of these things. They're very powerful things, but they are 2D. We're looking at the Earth's surface. When you do what we mean by 2.5D here is, first of all, just to point out, it's not really 3D. Again, that's not poking any, trying to put anything down, just to realize that it's not really 3D, because 3D involves volume. But we get these nice images like this. Bob Crippen's coming next week from JPL, and he will blow your socks off with all sorts of beautiful surface images. He's the master of that stuff. But here's a beautiful picture. Here we are in the Willamette Valley here. And what a nice picture. It shows you things, and there's certainly nothing wrong with it, but we're still on the Earth's surface, but we're seeing the relief. We can drape things. This is Long Valley Caldera here, down in the east side of the Sierra Nevada. We've taken the geologic map now, draped it on the digital topography, and we've got this 2.5 dimensional kind of view. But we're not looking into the Earth. This certainly gives us insights that might help us look into the Earth, but we're not looking in. So if we go on to 3Ds, this is back to that kind of topography thing I showed you. This is kind of illustrating how Earthscope would be working. So we would have this big data volume here centered on the west coast, and we're getting pretty close to having seismographs and data streaming in from just about that whole footprint. But when it's all said and done, why, we're going to, these are hundreds of kilometers here. We're looking at the dipping plate underneath here, some sort of idea of what we expect to see. The fun part of Earthscope is going to be when we start seeing these results and see how different they are from what we thought they would be. Here is an attempt, just one that I was involved in the Rockies, which was has only an element of 3D to it, but it's mostly a 2D effort. But it was an effort to also do 4D. Trying to use the rock record, the geology, to go back in geologic time and actually try to do an evolution here. And so what is being shown here is there were this fellow Ken Duker at the University of Wyoming compiled all this stuff. Here were some of the lines of seismographs that we deployed. There was a previous effort here, Gene Humphreys down at the other university south of here was involved here with this line, and then the recent line across New Mexico. Well, taking all that kind of data and some regional data, Ken makes a picture here. And the best, it because you don't have an array of seismographs on there, you weren't necessarily in the field as long as we are now in these experiments, while you don't have the kind of complete kind of resolution that you would like. But at about 100 kilometers down in the Earth, he could see that was his best defined slice. So he's taken the 3D picture that's best resolved and has this here. And so we've abstracted some of the geology, the main geologic units here, and we're doing visualization by Marilyn Overland, Adobe Illustrator thing. Do it all the time. It's an honorable thing. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's, you know, ultimately it's not the kind of thing we want to do ultimately mathematically. But where the 4D comes in, and we've had great discussions among our research group about things like the black areas here are very young volcanic effects down here. Of course, here's Yellowstone National Park, so you would expect the Snake River Plain and especially Yellowstone to show up as an area of low velocity. It's very hot. Temperature causes, high temperature reduces the velocity, and that's what we're seeing. But when you get down here to New Mexico and Colorado, why the interpreting these things, these areas of high and low velocity, becomes a little more interesting. The thing that allows us to think about going back in geologic time is that this red line here is a boundary that's 1.8 billion years old. The internal cratonal core of Western North America is this Wyoming province. And 1.8 billion years ago, we had the Mojave terrain come in, collide, and then had a series of these collisions. And up until about 1.1 billion years, you had a southward growing continent, much the way that the more recent history of this continent has moved westward. And we're standing on a very recent addition to North America here, right at Corvallis. So. And not the most stable one in the world either. So. And but as you attempt to, we can extract 3D from this by taking slices along where we really had seismograph. The intervening area is not so well resolved, but where we actually had the arrays, why that's where these are being shown. These dipping features, interesting. You've got a north dipping feature here underneath the Cheyenne Belt. You've got a south dipping one here in the upper mantle underneath the kind of this area. You're seeing it also on the La Ristra line here. So I won't go into the geologic story, but it is at least, you know, we're getting toward 3D. So maybe this is 2.75D or something. We're trying to assign geologic age of these. But if you look exactly along that profile, the one on the very first slide, down here are xenolith data. So we're trying to look at these samples that have come to the surface thanks to volcanic eruptions, but are actually pieces of the mantle and the lower crust. Here, that's all been integrated into this story. And here's that north dipping blue layer here that looks like a slab that might be 1.8 billion years old. That doesn't square very well with the geology, because the geology suggests this was going this way. So an alternate interpretation of it is really kind of a rifted margin of this 1.8, right before this 1.8 event. About 2 billion years ago, it looks like there was a passive margin here. You go to the Snowy Mountains of Wyoming, they're absolutely gorgeous, big white marbles standing up on end and everything, and it's a carbonate sequence from a passive margin. And we're still arguing about what the aspen anomaly is, and there's an experiment underway to fill in this hole. So, and the little red squiggles are the receiver functions from the mantle, and an attempt with data overlays and integration to come up with an integrated story here for things. So four dimensions, of course, is time, and time, when things start varying with time, why you think of animations, and that can be a long period of geologic time or maybe just a short one. But the project that we're working together on here for Central and Eastern Oregon is one in which we're really trying to put together a story. It will be 3D from a geophysical perspective, and we're trying to figure out how to use the rocks to allow us to go back in time, look at tectonic models, and so forth. And here's an attempt to kind of show the kind of how far back in time we can go. But Anita and the other geology teacher, chemistry people, look how much of geologic time we're going to depend on them for, you know. So I hope they're planning to work hard on this project. So, but anyway, you that's the only way you can get back there. You can't, you know. I mean, several of us in the room are seismologists. We can do the world's best resolved seismic experiment you can imagine, but it is just a snapshot of the velocity structure of the Earth today. We can't change that fact. So, so at any rate, this is kind of a thought diagram of how we would think through all these ways that we integrate this stuff. But here, going back to that Colorado experience, here's the gravity model that I made to kind of integrate across this Cheyenne Belt boundary. But the whole point here is trying to sit with our geologic colleagues and figure out a coherent interpretation for the P-wave velocity, and then the couplings we have for CD-ROM, and La Rista we have PN, S-wave tomography. And here's a density structure that matches the generally matches the seismic results. And here's the near surface stuff that we got both from the seismic and drilling. And much like the Polish example, this is stuff that is correlates very, very well, surprisingly well, with the known surface geology from drilling results. And all this part is well modeled in terms of shortcuts. Now, the end result here, this movie goes off pretty fast here. I think I can make it. Let's see if I can make it show here. So get ready to watch the movie now. We're going to explode a spot down in the Earth, and we're going to see the seismic waves. Ooh, we went the wrong way, didn't we? So, let's see. Movies are always interesting. All right, so I think. Yes, there it goes. Boom, bomb, boom, bomb. So what we're just trying to show here then is that a way to get 4D, from geophysics at least, is to build models of one sort or another that that model true behavior here. Now, this wasn't really in a sense of, this is a short time in the sense of a shot and so forth. And I'll show you some real results that show you 4D in terms of modeling physical phenomena here at the end of this. Well, ultimately, the multidimensional is just an attempt to say that, well, we're talking about all the physical attributes we could measure. We can't measure these things back in time, but we can use geological data of one sort to reconstruct things back in time. And so really what we're talking about are truly highly multidimensional models that include interfaces. So we're back to the voxel-based things to start with, and then putting geologic flesh from geophysical discontinuities that we can detect, and from geologic reasoning, and so forth. Well, how might we actually do this? Well, this is the real challenge, and I've been trying to work with the ESRI group, because I believe GIS is got the potential to be able to handle this kind of thing. And it was kind of an interesting story, because we got involved with the group building a groundwater geologic model. And if we can imagine them building that out to a bigger scale, well, it's a lot of the same elements are. So we've had at least a thought exercise that I'll share with you here, where the idea is to build editable models of the Earth using GIS technology. And and of course, you know, here, as I've said several times, all these different kinds of schemes of integrating into that model geologic constraints, different varieties of geophysical constraints here is really the ultimate game. But here's that tomographic picture again. Let me just kind of, that's the starting point, is what my point here. And this was the slice I showed you before. Here's interesting, here's an even deeper slice. So the interesting thing here is that it looks like these things are cold, even down to 200, 250 kilometers, so much deeper than we first thought. And now here's the vertical slice through the volume. So now we're looking along the surface of the Earth and looking at a vertical slice, and you can see the outline of the route and how much of this is. There's technical issues about streaking in these images and so forth, but there's certainly no doubt that there's a well-resolved, rather deep route for this this area, part of the world. So how do we start? We've built a model of this block, so how might we start to embellish this sum? And certainly an easy way to do it, there are empirical, when I say empirical, I mean it's not based on, it makes physical sense, but it's based on just curve fitting of two different data type A with data type B. Well, we can do that in this case, and we can calculate the density for these blocks and end up deriving a model that jointly satisfies the density and seismic results. Well, this GIS story then is kind of picking up from that point, and this is from a fellow who's just recently finished his PhD, Gil Strasberg. And he has done, kind of within most of you that are GIS people, this is very kind of formal. He's actually got he's put this data model out. The ESRI guys are working with it. It's going to show up on the web, and the community will or will not, I feel sure they will, buy in to this structure. But he took the usual stuff that you have from the surface story, drainage networks and things like that, and started looking down boreholes and solids and layers down in the earth, and that's when we got together. And so the points, some of you would recognize, how you take these little features from in GIS, and you can these are points, and so you have this icon associated with that. And those of you that aren't in the GIS, don't worry about it. but at any rate, we have lines and areas and points here, the basic elements of GIS. So these are all from Gill's groundwater thing, and they make perfect, they translate perfectly into a more general geologic data model. But here's the vapor, okay? This is vaporware here, mostly. There is at least a geo volume that you can come out of this thing. It's called a multi-patch. It's not a very, not spatially aware. You can't calculate the volume of it, for instance, or its surface area. But at least it's a 3D object in a GIS structure. A boundary between two geologic units. I can let that have all the complexity I want. And it could also be a multi-path. But of course, images and surfaces could be rasters in a GIS. A boundary could also be represented by a triangulated irregular network, a 10, and a geologic unit could be defined as the region between any two boundaries. So that's what we would. Kind of the structure we would like to start having, and then the voxels would be the areas between these interfaces. So these are the kinds of geologic flesh we would like to be able to look at. Here would be an example of a 3D seismic survey here. A couple of these examples were provided by this company Earth Vision that's up or down in the Bay Area that they're targeting the oil business, so there are lots of salt domes in these pictures. But here's a domal feature, but the idea, they do have the software whereby you can drape a tin over any surface in this thing, extract that tin boundary, and you have a geo boundary for this data structure. If you look here at Yucca Mountain, here would be you know, the stratigraphy, so the straddle interfaces or the geo boundaries, the stratigraphic units here are the units, faults cutting the thing as the geo surfaces, and then geo areas is something actually on the surface of the earth. This allows you to, the whole idea is to be able to like cut, have arbitrary cuts through this, so anything like any sort of cut through a data volume like that produces a section, and then you bore lines, especially when you have deeper wells, you have to realize they do not, they're not straight, so you don't just hang a straw from the surface of the earth, you have to actually digitally indicate the trajectory of the well. As some of you know today, companies are really deliberately drilling horizontal wells and getting better production from their wells. Other, just another example of taking a boundary out of some 2D seismic data here where that's being displayed in sectional form. So the volume here would be an example of a volume that would be, in this case, this is some sort of contaminant plume that you've that's getting out of an area, and you're coloring it in according to the concentration of whatever pollutant is involved. And again, here's the geo volume in the form of these salt domes, which could be other, of course, kinds of things. If you put it on a bigger scale here, this is from a thing we developed in Geon. If you're interested in this, sorry, this is called the IDV, been developed at UNAVCO. Chuck Merton's there, and you can go to the UNAVCO website and pick up what this is a visualization software that was designed by the atmospheric community, and they were able to get it to work down in the earth. So what's being done here is you're picking some velocity value and you're wrapping a surface in it. So these blobs here are low velocity blobs. Here's the whole outline of Africa here and in a goofy coordinate system, but we can enclose and look at volumes in these tonographic volumes. And of course, again, you want to have all sorts of exotic ability to slice this data here again as salt domes, and being able to run a cross section through here and see the geology come out of these things. Here's another example of a thrust fault here. We're actually cutting, seeing the thrust planes, we're actually cutting back in here and around on this thing in a rather exotic fashion. So the trouble is, this doesn't exist yet. I can say from talking to the big bosses at Esri that they're thinking about it. They're getting pushed on this. I would never claim that our group is the only one pushing them about a voxel-based model, but they are thinking about it, and I do think they're going to do it. I just have no idea when. So Mr. Dangerman does not show all of his cards when you talk to him about things. So here, just going back to kind of an Earthscope story here, this would be just how, if they did bring that kind of capability, this is just kind of a thought diagram of some of the different kinds of data we would bring in to build up this model and insert the surfaces and create a data structure that we can query the way I'm just showing it. So now, so here's a nice visualization here using the IDV, and this of course is Mount St. Helens. You all are, I thought this was a good example to show you guys. And so what's going to be shown here, here's the surface topography here, and Greg Waite with the USGS has gone back and looked at their earthquake catalog and recalculated epicenter or hypocenter locations, and you can see, look at this stream of these guys just right underneath the basically the middle of Mount St. Helens. And then what's going to show up on here is the tomography. We're going to take two perpendicular slices through the tomographic volume. There's plenty of earthquakes, plenty of seismographs, so at least for the middle of the upper crust, there's a pretty well-defined tomographic model. And so we can rotate that around. So the reds, again, are the slow velocities, and the dots are the epicenters, and then we're using that ISO volume. So the really slow velocities are being shown here as these gray blocks. So they don't seem to correlate in any straightforward way with the earthquakes. I guess the most remarkable thing I see of this is just seeing the earthquake so perfectly aligned, more or less right underneath that, the apex of the mountain. Little problems with the tomography, like things sticking up above the ground and stuff, so there are a few little things to be worked out. Now, the truly ultimate thing here, and I'll close with this, is now we've built a model. Imagine we've built a model, and the folks down at the Southern California Earthquake Center, SCAC, have built a rather sophisticated model. It's not the ultimate model that we talked about here, but it certainly deserves just a very, very good try to build a velocity model, and then they have inserted the main strands of the San Andreas Fault into that, and built then a mesh model that through which they could actually simulate an earthquake. And so what we're going to see is a magnitude 7.7 earthquake show up down at the Salton Trough, which happens to be part of the San Andreas there in Southern California that has not moved in a while, and therefore they're worried about it. And this is the simulation that took, these are 240 big-ass processors, not this. And so 240 big-ass processors working for a total of 5 days. It turned out 20,000 hours of CPU time went into this little sucker here. And a fellow at did the visualization, but it was the SCAC team that did this. So here's the earthquake, and what's being shown here then is the surface displacement here from this magnitude 7.7 earthquake, and it's showing this big section of the San Andreas Fault break here, and then it's breaking along here, and these are all that complexity is not numerical noise, it's a result of the complexity of the earthquake source and the fault pattern. And then of course Los Angeles is built on a big basin, so it sits there and just shakes like heck for quite a while. So even a magnitude 7 down here quite a ways from Los Angeles will probably do a fair bit of damage here. So as Los Angeles shakes here, gets ready to quit shaking, why I'll thank you for your attention and be happy to answer any questions. Still shaking.
Can we see that movie again?
Sure. Not a good day to be in Palm Springs. And what, Esri is right here. Build that box of models.
Representing permanent deformation?
No.
Right along the pump there.
Yeah, I don't think that's what's intended.
Are the variations because of slight changes in curvature of the fault?
Yeah, it's a combination of the faults, the interaction of the different strands, the physical properties in the area, and then, of course, when you're out here, it's all that loose sediment shaking around.
Randy, you had one of your early slides, you had an IG on. So as I understand, this earthquake was caused by the fault that San Diego.
Yeah.
But it
Yes, it is, absolutely. Well, about that portal structure is ideas for people to, you know, when you work with data, first of all, any effort like this is not an attempt to grab everybody's data, okay? It's an attempt to, we're happy to host your data as a backup, as a primary, frankly, I think it's a good idea to let somebody like Dion at least back up your data. But we're also perfectly happy to have you have your data on your computer. But come in, register your data, register your software tools, and the idea is a person can go in query, go into the portal, create a worker space, and then be able to be able to discover data sets you wouldn't have thought about. We're building these things called ontologies, which Tom Jordan at SCEC said, one thing I hope before I finish the project is I can use the word ontology and help people get a sentence. So, I don't think he or I, either one, can quite do it yet. But actually, I think about ontology, it's a formal structure. Of course, Mark DeHaven's been here, he's bound to talk about ontologies and so forth, and trying to visualize them and so forth. But it's a way of discovering relationships and formalizing vocabulary. And it's important to then register your data sets to ontologies and so forth. But I think the goal is to be able, you'd be working there on that portal, and you would actually discover not just some data, but a relationship that you wouldn't have thought previously, and it would help you make your scientific result better.
So, a few years ago, Ron tried something from how he did the thing.
So, a lot of people have done some things like this in local areas.
Has anyone run a similar simulation on the quake that actually happened to see how closely it matched what really happened?
They must be trying some of the big, their problem here is they haven't had the big model of San Andreas fall.
They've had some overture.
Yeah, the trouble is they've had the thrust events here, and then they've had these things out in the Mojave like the landers there, but they have not really had the one, in a way they don't want to have it because they don't want to have to deal with it, but it does. They have to. It was a big job to build this. I, of course, am not familiar with the nitty-gritty details, but they...
several structures in place.
Yes.
One
comment about the parachute model. Visualization showed clearly was that when you did the rupture in the opposite direction, that you got a completely different kind of phenomenon in the Los Angeles space. The visualization would help guard that component.
Sure.
The ITR program is gone in SLU, right? So, and there are other groups that are kind of big modeling environments. SCEC, for example, is another one, portal for model development or the repository. How do you view the future of all these different efforts?
Well, the cyber infrastructure is being pushed over into the facility side of NSA. And then I was talking to someone today, it's a little weird. They have NSF has an office of cyber infrastructure that seems to want to direct things but not fund them. But maybe some guys from FEMA moved over there or something. But at any rate, we're working our way through this. Geon is finishing, SCEC just finished its first 5 years, and it got a renewal of sorts for its IPR part. You can't use that word for cyber infrastructure. And then Geon, this is our 5th year, so we're trying to figure out how to write the right proposal so we have to kind of
finished really building that. So, you know, a lot of work, a lot of pieces have been built, but, you know, it's really not coming together the way that you imagine.
Can I ask one other question?
Sure.
What is the lot size?
Well, the way I usually, it's a perfectly square lot, it would not have to necessarily be that. And like, when you do two interfaces, one thing I kind of imagine is there's so much within the topographic volume, there's more variance in velocity than it's physically real, and figuring out some little operator that would go through the 3D volume between the two interfaces and do some sort of regional 3D averaging and replace the center box. So those of you that do remote sensing know about the convolution operators working across the data, just getting them in 3 dimensions to do that. And that way you wouldn't end up with soak up on the boxes. That's kind of the way I imagine when we get to the ultimate geologic flesh, that maybe we won't preserve all those boxes. We're preserving until such time you go back and you think about it. If it started with a seismic tomographic result, after I get through putting all this geologic flesh on it, I want to go back and rerun the tomography and be sure I still match that data. Yeah, hope that I do. You know, and then you're going to iterate some. But when you're finally done, you may choose to display it to try to find the geologic story, by not the document material. But it'd still be a prism-like column.
Well, Dr. Keller will be up there for a few more minutes if you'd like to come up and speak to him individually. And Randy, thank you so much. You've been one of our most popular speakers. We had to extend his visit to 2 days to talk to all of the scientists and students who are interested in interacting with him. And for this, we're very appreciative, and we'd like to give you a copy of our geovisual digital poster and also an OSU Geosciences Club baseball cap. Very important for your trip home.
Yeah, well, very important when the sun's out for, given I have the haircut I have, I need that.
Thank you.